This week, Sacramento's Catholic Diocese announced a list of 44 priests and two deacons who've credibly abused children and young adults. We'll speak with a lawyer who represents victims. Governor Gavin Newsom has a new plan for high-speed rail, plus at least 10 of the presidential hopefuls will be coming to California later this month. That's all in our weekly Cap Chat segment. Also, we'll delve into the business of making comic books with two local creators. And Submerge Magazine co-founder Jonathan Caraba gives us a sneak peek at some upcoming concerts. I'm Randall White in for Beth Ryak today. That is all coming up on Insight. First, here's the news. From Capital Public Radio in Sacramento, this is Insight. I'm Randall White. In today for Beth Ryak, and we want to give you this advisory right off the top. The first segment is a difficult one, but it's an important topic, but it might not be appropriate for all listeners. You've surely seen the headlines. Earlier this week, the Sacramento Catholic Diocese released the names of 44 priests, two deacons, who the church says can credibly be listed as abusers of 130 children and young adults up to the age of 25. Nearly half of those sexually abused were the victims of just three priests. This information comes from an examination of approximately 1,500 personnel records spanning at least seven decades, starting in 1950. The reviewers of those records are said to be staff of the diocese and an independent consulting firm. Joining us now in the studio is Sacramento-based attorney Joe George. He's founding partner of the law offices of Joseph C. George and has represented clergy sexual abuse victims for several decades. We really appreciate you being here on Insight to help us understand the weight of this week's released list of names.
My pleasure. Thank you, Randall.
Now, the Sacramento Diocese list, as I said in the introduction, Joe, included 44 priests and two deacons. Is there a particular reason why the diocese is doing this now?
That's an interesting question. Bishop Soto indicated in his public relations release through Kevin Eckery, their media person, that they are trying to recover the trust of Catholics in the public by beginning with the accounting of what happened in the past. Curiously, Bishop Soto has been the Bishop of Sacramento for 11 years, so I don't know why this thought didn't occur to him sometime in the past. As a matter of fact, Bishop Soto was the auxiliary bishop in the Diocese of Orange to Bishop Todd Brown from 2000 to 2007. So he is steeped in the misconduct of the Catholic Church hierarchy. Why did he wait? That's, for me, it's a rhetorical question. They waited till now because of the release of the Pennsylvania Grand Jury Report. Mm-hmm. So the Pennsylvania Grand Jury Report, which was made public in this last August, just excoriated the hierarchy of the Catholic Church. It's deplorable conduct. As soon as that was released, attorney generals across the country indicated an interest and willingness to get involved in the diocese within their state. And our own attorney general reached out to victims of child sexual abuse in general, not just clergy child sexual abuse, to file reports, I think, to try to cut the legs out from the attorney generals. The bishops across the country now have come up with this plan to release lists of credibly accused perpetrators.
Do you believe it's a complete list?
No, not at all.
What leads you to think that?
Well, you know, historically, what we talk about with child molesters, and it applies to the hierarchy of the Catholic Church, has been to deny, minimize, and blame. They're very, very, very skilled at that. The list, if you want to focus just on the list released here in the Diocese of Sacramento, It's very curious that Bishop Soto's focus was 44 priests and 2 deacons. Okay?
How so?
That means no nuns, no Christian brothers, no lay teachers, no coaches, no volunteers in schools. In fact, no one in schools except priests. And the priests aren't in the schools here.
And of the 3 priests that have the highest number of accusations, 2 are now in Mexico and 1 is deceased. Is that right?
Blanco's dead. Father Blanco's dead. And you're speaking, I guess, about Beltran and Garcia. They're both fugitives. We represent, and so curiously, the numbers are minimized in Soto's report. One way they minimized it was not include all that other group, right? That's one way. They list, I think, like over 50, 55, 60, quote, victims of Blanco, Garcia, and Beltran. We've represented over 50 of those guys, almost all Hispanic males, all children.
The victims.
The victims. Mm-hmm. All children of relatively poor, mostly itinerant farm workers up and down the valley. And these perpetrators had carte blanche with the kids. The families would be thrilled that Father Garcia was spending time with their child, inviting their child to spend the night, giving their child gifts, bestowing them with meals. So one less mouth to feed, in effect. One less mouth to feed, excuse me.
We say the Sacramento Diocese, but it's really large. Can you help us understand the geographic boundaries of the diocese?
Yeah, Sacramento is much larger than you would think. I think there are over 1 million parishioners. It runs up. It doesn't have the coastline. Santa Rosa runs up the coastline, Eureka, up that way. But otherwise, it's Sacramento runs up to Oregon and cuts over to Nevada. There are a lot of rural areas that have never been scrutinized, if you ask me. And I know because I've been around since doing it since the early 90s. So in other words, then they'll get a report on, let's say, a Father Delgado from Susanville. He was in Susanville. One known victim, okay? Child abuse. He came from south of Lodi, and we know that he would bring a kid, quote, nephew from Mexico who was staying with him in Lodi before he wound up in Susanville. So the claim actually comes from when he was in Sacramento, not Susanville. But he'd been up in Susanville in these rural areas for years and years and years. Okay. Psychological evidence, psychiatric evidence, medical evidence would indicate that pedophiles, sexual abusers are recidivists.
Okay. Meaning they repeat the act over and over.
And repeat, yeah. And repeat. Some way more aggressive than others, like Garcia and Beltran and Blanco. They would never pass up an opportunity to sexually abuse a kid if they had access to the kid. Others may be not quite that aggressive. But to make believe that the numbers on these perpetrators are only 2 or 3 victims is make-believe.
Now, the list was put together, as we said, by the diocese staff and an independent consulting firm. What do you know about that firm?
The firm was involved, I think, in the John Jay study, and she's some sort of consultant, former FBI something. The diocese, all the dioceses love former FBI people. It somehow lends an air of credibility, they think. Again, the focus, though, is minimizing. And to take a step back again, the other day we had a press conference with a young man, I'm giving my age here, but he was like 45, 47. And he was a whistleblower on Brother Farrington and Jesuit in 1987. Farrington pulled him out of a class, molested him. He came back into the class, told his teacher, told his parents that night. The parents the next day met with Diocese of Sacramento. And then the following day, Brother Farrington was dispatched out of Jesuit for, quote, personal reasons. Farrington's not on this list.
And so
he's an acknowledged perp. And Bishop Soto, I understand that the reason is, well, we didn't list brothers. So we're not listing, I mean, Jesuit's a high profile, a great school here locally. And the Jesuits, by and large, are great order and doing great things. But we have a serial sexual abuser, Farrington, who's been omitted. I know nuns sexually abused girls at St. Francis, probably Loretto. I know we have a case that's been in the media in the last year here. A softball coach, Michael Martis, was prosecuted, sexually abused our client at St. Francis. No coaches are listed. No lay teachers are listed. If I was a Catholic, I was born and raised Catholic, educated Catholic, wouldn't I want to know what's going on in the Catholic schools where my kids go? They've completely omitted data from the Catholic schools. Now, do we think that's going to keep the numbers down and to help frame the picture so that it looks like it's not quite as extensive as it is? Yes.
We're speaking with Sacramento-based attorney Joe George, who represents victims of clergy sexual abuse. What about future prosecutions? Joe, where do we stand with those?
Hopeful. To take a step back and look at Bishop Soto's statement, and these are statements, you know, again, across the country.
And these are his statements that came out at the time that this list was released?
Correct. He uses words like evil acts, sins and failures. Now, we've had access to personnel files back into the 60s and 70s and 80s. They love euphemisms, they being the hierarchy of the Catholic Church. They talk about poor decisions, inappropriate behaviors. These are crimes. Criminal child sexual abuse is child sexual abuse. These are criminal acts. And to cover up criminal acts is criminal, if you ask me. So we are thrilled that our attorney general, I think in September, this last September, October, sent out a request for reports of child sexual abuse to be made to the attorney general. Okay, we're thrilled, and we're hopeful that our attorney general's office will get in the act, because the last thing in the world that the bishops want in California and across the country is for law enforcement to start issuing subpoenas and warrants to get into their files. Because I'm telling you, I'm a civil lawyer. And since the late 80s and 90s, all we do is get stonewalled. They destroy. They've never known ever anything about any priest who's ever sexually abused.
And as I understand it, just this week, the attorney general in Georgia is doing just what you're hoping you'll see in California.
Absolutely.
Yeah. So Pope Francis has placed a lot of emphasis on solving the problem of predatory priests. He has had any level of success, in your opinion, that you can determine?
I haven't been intimately involved or focused on what Pope Francis does. He's a charismatic, charming individual who always has said this right thing since he got in there and sort of gave a ray of hope. I think little has actually been done to take it back several decades. You know, Rome thought that the problem was created by the American media, that the problem was limited to the United States, and it was American media, and it's those darn bishops over in America who can't control the media anymore. That's the problem. We wouldn't be having this conversation, I should add, and these historic developments wouldn't be occurring but for the courage of the sexual abuse survivors
coming forward,
who've spoken and spoken and spoken. Yeah. And snap Survivors Network of those abused by priests and the people at Bishop Accountability have just been fabulous. They're the gutsy. They're the gutsy people.
We should mention that you're an attorney now, but you have a psychology background, correct?
I'm also a licensed psychologist.
Licensed psychologist.
Yeah, I was a licensed psychologist in the early 80s. I was a psychologist first before I went to law school. And I know a little bit about psychology.
And, you know, you mentioned that this is a decades-old problem. So for many of the victims, their abusers have either passed away or are living in other countries, as we mentioned earlier. How do they find any sense of, I know that's a term that a lot of people don't like, but closure?
What I think most folks are looking for is some sort of recognition of accountability. Mm-hmm. And so,
whether that's by the church or by the abusers.
Yeah, the abusers ring hollow, frankly. And you know, again, the diocese and the bishops across the country have always talked about, well, there are always a couple of bad apples there. Every group has a bad apples. The bad apples here is the corporate policy. It was corporate criminal behavior that's deplorable conduct by the hierarchy of the Catholic Church, moving these perps around and not warning parents and kids. And their number one goal was to avoid scandal and save money, and that's what they did.
Do you see the culture changing in the United States in favor of the victims?
Yes. I think that, you know, it's interesting because I've lived through it somewhat. I was, you know, again, I was born, raised, educated Catholic. I wasn't sexually abused by clergy, but part of my affinity for this work is I could easily have been a victim. my son went to Catholic school. We could easily be a victim.
Did you see signs of it, but you were able to, you know, get yourself out of that situation?
You know, I thought about that some. And, you know, I'm old, so I went to high school in the late 60s. And I remember being cornered in a it was his office, chemistry teacher's office, and he was sort of pushing me up against the wall. I went in to complain about a grade, I think, in chemistry, right? So I was a junior in high school, and he was like moving in on me, and I remember being squirmish and going out. At the time, it never occurred to me that maybe he was going to pin me up against the wall and I was going to feel his hard penis rubbing up against me.
But looking back now,
it's like, what was that motive? It's almost like hearing women talk about Joe Biden hugging them. Like, you know, it
you
didn't feel comfortable.
Factor, right.
It didn't feel comfortable. It was, you know, a little too inappropriate. And so.
What was the turning point, do you think? We were talking about the culture changing. Of course, there was that Academy Award winning film about the work done
Spotlight.
By the Boston Globe. Was there anything here on the West Coast that you would see as a turning point?
Well, we had our own open window for the statute of limitations in 2003. So that was extraordinary because in my work, I would get my brains pounded for years losing cases based upon the statute of limitations. We would lose again and again and again. And gradually the legislature helped by extending the statute of limitations. And then we had an open window in 2003. There were 1,000 claims filed in the state, almost all against the Catholic Church. We had Episcopal cases too, but almost all against the Catholic Church. Then it was like Catholic Church was like, oh my God, we're out of business. What are we going to do? And then those cases got resolved. And then a curious thing happened, like over the next 5 years, is the calls didn't stop.
Oh.
And so then I would say, like, well, did you know there was a window in 2003? But the nature of the abuse, it's a psychological abuse, and that's where it fits in with my psychology background, is sort of box it up and put it away. And if something triggers it later, we'll deal with it later. But in the meantime, leave me alone.
Mm-hmm.
And so a lot more of those folks now, because of the publicity, frankly, and some of the publicity, you know, I've thought about it. And we went through 03. And there was this grand jury I just mentioned. But back in like 05 or 07, there was a Philadelphia grand jury. I'm from Philadelphia. And she was a Jewish district attorney. She got all the Catholics in the office to head up the grand jury. Jill Abraham, she's a judge now. And it was excoriating report against the Archdiocese of Philadelphia. Again, I that's where I am from.
Right.
It sort of fell on deaf ears. It just went away. Then I remember a couple years later, I was vacationing I was in New York for reasons, and Jerry Sandusky's story broke.
Right.
And I'm from Pennsylvania, so I know Penn State football. But Sandusky's abuse of his kids, he adopted, he had a lot of foster kids, received far more, it was a different audience. It expanded. And then over the years, we have U.S. Gymnastics with Larry Nassar, Bill Cosby stuff, Harvey Weissman stuff.
Right.
And women, frankly, that I've spoken to 10 years ago about being molested in clergy, these clergy cases. They'd say, well, he only felt my breasts. That's the same thing the boys tried when they were in high school, too. They have a different attitude today. It's more like, you know, that shouldn't happen.
It's noticeably changed.
Noticeably changed.
That's Sacramento-based attorney Joe George, who represents victims of clergy sexual abuse. Thank you so much for sharing your thoughts with us here on Insight today.
My pleasure, Randall. Appreciate it.
And we do have more on the website at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight. This is your NPR station, Capital Public Radio. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Randall White in for Beth React today. Okay, we're going to talk budgets, but it's not nearly as boring as it may sound, so stick with me because I've got Ben Adler here, and it's always an entertaining conversation. Then each May, Ben, California's governor updates lawmakers on how he'd like to spend the state's money, right? This process kicks off the final stage of budget negotiations in the state legislature. One big spending item, high-speed rail. And there's been an update. Capitol Bureau Chief Ben Adler joins us to explain all of this and more for this week's Cap Chat segment. Ben?
Hey.
Yesterday, state officials announced changes to the high-speed rail project's business plan. Now, what do those changes look like?
So they're updating the business plan released last year with new cost estimates. And what this really is, if we set all the dollars aside, this is the first moment, formal moment, where Governor Gavin Newsom's new focus or attempted focus,
Central Valley focus,
takes shape for California's very embattled high-speed rail project.
Yeah.
In his State of the State, he managed to confuse just about everyone by saying, look, the project is currently planned, would take too long, cost too much. There isn't a path right now to go from the Bay Area to Southern California, but there is a path to go from Merced to Bakersfield in the Central Valley. That's what he said.
And Twitter blew up instantly while he was still talking during the speech. I was watching it and I was like,
Twitter blew
cow.
Up, yeah. Cable news blew up. Everyone misinterpreted what the governor was saying and in
misinterpreted or
took the words at face value because the governor right. wasn't particular. I mean, well, look, part of it is he also said we're going to keep doing environmental work and regional projects, but nobody heard that because everyone was paying so much attention to the first part of what he said.
Right.
And also the words like bookends and phase one don't mean anything to 99.5% of the state legislature, let alone the Twitterverse. So given that, there was a lot of confusion. But in fact, what the governor is doing or is seeking to do is to extend the first part of track being built in the Central Valley by an extra 50 miles.
And that'll bring it into Bakersfield?
Into downtown Bakersfield, because for whatever reason, the track was going to end at the northern outskirts of town, which I don't know about you, but if I was on high-speed rail, I'm not sure I'd want to get off in Elk Grove.
right.
So into downtown Bakersfield, and instead of starting in the north in Madera, which is a town just north of Fresno, it would extend further north to Merced. So you've got larger population centers. Whether or not there could be any legitimate ridership on that segment, that's an open question. The Newsom administration and the High Speed Rail Authority say they've got some evidence from an early train operator study to say, yeah, we think there could be. What everyone's really eyeing is what's called valley to valley, Silicon Valley to the Central Valley, or more accurately, the other way around, because then people could live in the Central Valley and commute into Silicon Valley. And so that is what people are eyeing as an interim step, but you still need to do a heck of a lot to get there. And so we've got some, and there's no real, it's way too early to even really start talking about going through Pacheco Pass from the Central Valley into the Gilroy area and then cutting up that valley into Silicon Valley. Way too soon for that. What we're talking about right now is the Central Valley stretch of track, and we have some new cost estimates for that.
And in your example, it's not a slight to Elk Grove. It's just, as the Capitol Bureau Chief, you want to get all the way into Sacramento.
Drop me off right at the state capitol.
Right, okay. In response to the deadly shooting at the synagogue in San Diego County this last weekend, the governor announced he'd include $15 million in funding to improve security at what are called soft targets throughout the state, including houses of worship. Do you think that that funding is likely to be approved?
I think there's a good chance. I mean, $15 million with an M dollars is what we call budget dust. In other words, we're talking about a general fund that's going to be $130-140 billion. And so given that, $15 million, especially when revenues are coming in well, quite well right now, and especially in the past few weeks.
Yeah, we just had a new report, right, that sort of made up for the weak report that came out a month or so ago.
Yeah, so because of the, and most likely it's because of the new federal tax law, so it shifted when a lot of rich people were paying taxes. There's a lot less money that came in, several billion dollars less in January. That was made up for in spades in April. And so I think it's very likely $15 million will be approved. Whether there's other changes that the governor will announce, I think it's pretty likely that he will have certain things that he'll be pushing. But he did make a lot of proposals in January with his original budget proposal, and we'll see how it goes. Now, we can get to some tape from the governor yesterday when I asked him about the money coming in. And, he was, a lot of money, billions of dollars came in. And he said, good news, but not amazing news.
There's some costs that obviously will be adjusted in the May revise that also will offset, I hope, overly exuberant legislators that may see this as too good news when, in fact, it's modestly good news.
You sound like Jerry Brown. Sure.
I think it's the vocation. But it's true. Look, I think what Jerry may have said it a little too early, that the skies are getting darker in the horizon. But I would be remiss if I didn't say the skies are darkening on the horizon, and we better prepare for that rainy day.
It's vocational, he says.
Which I think is Gavin Newsom speak for saying it's part of the job of the governor to take that line of fiscal caution.
Right. Back to the high-speed rail there. The cost is going up, correct?
Yes. We want to circle back to that real quick because one of the big takeaways from yesterday's report is that it's going to cost an extra $1.8 billion, according to the High-Speed Rail Authority, to do the current stretch of 119 miles of track from Madera to the northern outskirts of Bakersfield. Total of about $12.5 billion. They're projecting around $18 billion for the total, the full Central Valley initial operating segment from Merced to downtown Bakersfield. And they're saying to do all of that, plus the environmental work, including north and south for the full stretch from the Bay Area to Southern California and some regional projects, that's going to cost about $20.5 billion. Coincidentally or not, they say they're estimating that that's how much money in revenue they'll have available, $20.4 billion at least, maybe as much as $23.5 billion by 2030. And they're vowing to get the initial operating segment done by trains running on it by 2028. Will that happen? There's a lot of skepticism, and not just from Republicans, although it is loudest from Republicans. I'd say we'll wait and see. We're also waiting to see what the federal government does, the Trump administration, which is seeking to pause, stall, kill this project any way it can.
So when does the governor release his revised draft budget?
He hinted yesterday that it might come as soon as sometime next week. He said a few days before the deadline, which he's required to, of May 14th, which is a week from this coming Tuesday, 2 weeks from this past Tuesday. But he seemed to hint maybe sometime next week.
And then the legislature gets to sound off.
The constitutional deadline for the legislature to pass a budget is June 15th.
Mm-hmm. Finally, one quick one here. On Monday, you covered presidential candidate Beto O'Rourke's campaign stop at Modesto Junior College. Any significant announcements made there?
Well, he spent his entire day in the Central Valley, which was day three of his four-day trip. It also included L.A., San Francisco, and San Diego. Modesto, he didn't have events open to the public, unlike in the other three areas, but he did spend the day talking about climate change. He began with a walking tour at Yosemite National Park, and he made an announcement of his proposal for climate change. And then he came down to the Valley and held a couple of events at Modesto Junior College, which I was at, and our story's up at capradio.org. So
this will hardly be the last Democratic candidate that we're going to see.
Safe to say that California's getting a bit more attention later this month, the last weekend of this month that stretches into June. State Democratic Party's holding its convention. And here are the candidates that are we are told by the party are confirmed to appear. Booker, Buttigieg, Castro, Gillibrand, Harris, Hickenlooper, Inslee, Klobuchar, Swalwell, and Warren. Not yet confirmed, but working on it. Biden, O'Rourke, and Sanders. And who knows, maybe others on that. There are 20, and I think 21, because I think I saw that a Colorado senator Michael Bennett jumped into the race today.
I heard that on NPR just a moment ago.
And I think, Randall, you're next. So.
Yeah, I don't think so, but all because we moved up our primary. We're getting this attention, right?
It gives you a fighting chance.
All right. Cap Radio's Capital Bureau Chief Ben Adler. Always fun to talk with you, Ben. I'll see you in the newsroom in just a little bit.
Thanks. See ya.
We have more on our website at capradio.org/insight. You're listening to Insight on your NPR station. This is Capital Public Radio. You are listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Randall White in for Beth Ruyak. Comic book culture is inescapable. Avengers Endgame broke box office records last weekend. There are X-Men, Spider-Man, and Joker movies due out later this year. Even Black Panther scored a nomination for Best Picture at the Academy Awards this year. But does that bonanza of ticket sales translate to bigger audiences for people who create comic books? The very things these movies are based on. Here to help us dig into that question are two local creators. Eben Burgoon is a writer and educator known for his series B-Squad, Soldiers of Misfortune. Eben, welcome back to Insight.
Oh, always a pleasure.
Also joining us today is the new lead artist for B-Squad, Michael Calero. Michael, welcome back to Insight to you, too.
Thanks for having me.
And let's start off with a little expository dialogue bubble, you know, before we jump into the action, just to play on the comic book theme. Tell us about your upcoming event, Free Comic Book Day. We'll start with you, Eben.
Free Comic Book Day is a coast-to-coast event that happens at all the local small businesses, the comic book shops. So all over the country, you can go into your local comic book shop and get free comics. So all the major publishers put out, I think they're like 51 different comics you can choose from. We're going to be at A1 Comics in Roseville signing the book that we contributed to. But you can go to, there's Empire Comics Fall has a giant festival, Big Brother, all of them here
World's
in Sacramento.
Best. Yeah.
World's best. Like they're all doing something really cool.
So, Michael, you put a lot of work into putting one of these books together. Is it weird to give it away free?
No, for me, this is really cool because I've never actually been a part of Free Comic Book Day on the book side. I've gone to stores and done sketches and signings, but I've never actually had a product that was being given away. So I think it's great.
I said a lot of time goes into it, but as someone who's never created a comic book, I actually have no idea how much time goes into writing an issue, illustrating a page. Assuming everything goes smoothly and there's no hiccups, what does a typical production schedule look like?
There's kind of a rule like a page a day type of thing. So usually like a day to pencil, a day to ink, day to color. Writing is a little different because usually that's done all kind of in one chunk, and that's when artists like myself get the script, and then you got to break it down. And for me, I do a little bit more than most artists do. Usually, artists will just do the penciling or just do the inking. I do all three things. So,
Eben, you're the script guy. So how does that work? Are you constantly thinking in cliffhangers?
No, you have to be really mindful about a lot of things that when you're writing for other mediums, you don't have to really think about. Page turns are really, really important. Like, you don't want to put something super exciting on the right page because then people don't read your left page. You have to be really careful because it's a visual medium and you only get moments. For a Star Wars movie, you might get 400,000 frames to tell a story. For a comic, maybe 1,200 of those are. So it's needles in a haystack that you're looking for when you're writing a script.
How did you guys get into this? Like, where did it start? At what point did you go from being a fan to, or were you a fan originally?
Yeah. I grew up reading like Tintin comics and comics like in sixth grade. And at some point, I fell for that trap where it's like, you got to read chapter books and big boy books. And I got Bill Maher'd, I guess, And I decided, only lately, I think in the last, 5 to 6 years, I started to really realize, these are art, literature, they matter. They're part of our contemporary
culture.
Yes. Yeah. Stan Lee's a modern Shakespeare. I mean, right? The work that he's done has inspired, countless people to make art.
And Michael, were you just an artist and then you thought, my art sort of lends itself to comic books?
Yeah, this is all I've ever wanted to do since I was like a little kid, like really, really little, probably like, 5, 6 years old. I just wanted to draw comic books. And luckily I found a way to make money.
There's not a lot of people that are doing exactly what they wanted to do from 5 years old on.
No, I consider myself super lucky to have, one, been able to do it and make money, but also the idea, looking back and saying, I never really changed. I never strayed too far from that path. And so I've always been doing comic book art.
Yeah. And I don't want to delve too much into your finances, but you just mentioned make money. You can make money doing this.
Yeah. I mean, there's different ways. Like I do conventions almost every weekend, and that's a big part of how I make this my main job.
Uh-huh. Both of you supplement, though? As I understand, you sell socks, Eben? Is that right?
I'm a pretty fuzzy and ill-defined, I think is how I kind of characterize it. I make and design socks, but they're B-Squad socks. And we'll make our own merchandise. I've named streets.
So it's connected. Yeah.
Designed websites and all sorts of things to kind of like pad. But the comic book industry is very, very freelance. So you have to be kind of your own boss and find out where you're going to get that great paycheck.
Spend a day in the newsroom and any media project has hiccups. there are unforeseen things that can happen. What are the problems, the stumbling blocks that you can have when putting together a comic book?
I think one of the biggest ones is, you're on a deadline, of course, and when things when something goes wrong early, it usually leads to something stumbling along the way and pushing those things back.
So, is this like a script sort of?
Yeah, I probably shouldn't say this on air, but I'm behind on my scripts right now.
Writer's block. It happens to everyone. Right?
There's actually a lot of things that in my life I would use to kind of address my writer's block that I don't really have access to right now, and they're creating other kinds of problems and hiccups and other things. But that's a huge thing. And when that's the first step is the script. So if you you're late on that, then you're turning something over to the artist late. And then the artist is turning that over to the letterist late or the colorist late, so there's an assembly line and it can just all futter out of control really quick.
And Michael, you have the script. You just need to, I say just you, yeah. But yeah, you have to create,
just need to draw it all.
You have to create the artwork that matches that. What are your sort of, stumbling blocks?
For me personally, it's more about just not having enough time. Kind of going back to what the last question is, I do comic conventions every weekend, which means that my actual page time of working on a book is sometimes only Tuesday through Thursday. And so you got to get a lot done in a very short amount of time. So for me, that's always the biggest hurdle is, you know, how do I find the time to pencil, ink, color this full book while at the same time going out and all over the country and selling my art directly to fans?
A media interview, for instance, might interrupt your schedule. You said Tuesday through Thursday. It's a Thursday. So sorry
get
about
right
that.
Back to work after this.
He brought his Cintiq.
Oh, did he really? Okay. Hey, so I have to ask this question. The blockbuster movies that we mentioned off the top, do you see the public's interest in those driving more interest in the books themselves? And not just the books that are represented in the movies, but the comic book industry as a whole.
I think that one thing that's very true is that the mainstream interest in the films is definitely putting a lot more interest in the comic book world.
Mm-hmm.
I think with the books, like, I'm sure that there's upticks, but I'd think that it's still one of those things when you go to bigger comic book shows, people are pretty interested in taking pictures with the people that are dressing up, and that's great. Books are harder to kind of convince people to try especially when you're a smaller person that nobody's like really noticed. Like, it's like, hey, I've got a book. And they're like, but that's Will Smith over there. And he just walked by. So I'm going to go over there. Like, it's like, okay, cool. Well, I get it, but I have a cool book.
I have one too. Yeah.
So it can be a real struggle. And I think that people don't realize the fruit of the thing like Avengers Endgame. That all started with the local comic book store, like nurturing that seed, treating those misfits like normal people and letting them kind of come in and like get excited about this thing,
right?
And then turn it into a movie eventually. You know, like that was decades of fandom that eventually yielded this fruit that turned into $1 billion in a weekend for Disney.
Far more positive than, say, the character on The Simpsons that owns a comic book store.
Absolutely.
And is sort of a punching bag for jokes, right?
Yeah, that's one of those, I think, Simpsons stereotypes that is really unfortunate, because I think a lot of the mainstream does have this attitude about the local comic book store where it's like, oh, I don't want to go in there and get, like, ridiculed for not knowing what Avengers I want to read to start getting into that, you know. And that's the other hurdle of, I think, the industry itself. Mike and I talk about this all the time, is, like, why isn't there a trailer for a new comic book in front of the Avengers?
Oh, good point. Right.
I think it's the comic industry not doing a lot to capitalize on the – I mean, you have a movie that just made $1 billion, but when I went to that theater, there wasn't anything to point you – to the comics, other than the characters themselves. There's nothing in the comic book shop, for the most part, that matches what's happening on the screen, to where someone could just walk in and easily find those things. I mean, there's trade paperbacks that collect the stories that those comics are based off of, but I feel like the comic industry could be doing a lot more to capitalize on the amount of people that now know the characters.
I mean,
there used to be comics in grocery stores. Why is hardly anyone putting out books where just average non-comic readers can stumble upon them?
Point us to what we can expect this coming summer from you guys. Is that your next release?
Oh, yeah. No, yeah, that's really – well, the next thing is the Starburns Present books at Free Comic Book Day. We got six pages of B-Squad in that. And then Starburns Industries Press, which is the publisher of the people that make Rick and Morty and Community and all those things. They've picked up B-Squad now as a series, and they're going to be releasing like this giant size version of our books.
Congratulations.
Yeah. It's fantastic. I'm a little bit
like,
Gosh, books do, and it's crazy and wonderful, but, we're re-releasing and remastering a lot of the B-Squad, books, and Mike's doing new issues and I'm scripting new issues and,
it's exciting.
Yeah, that happens in June. Yeah. That starts in late June.
Congratulations to both of you. That's Eben Bragoon. You just heard Michael Calero. Free Comic Book Day is Saturday. You can attend their signing event, as we mentioned, at A1 Comics in Roseville. The Starburns Presents issue featuring work by Eben and Michael should be available at comic book stores near you. Thanks, you guys. I really appreciate you coming in here today.
All right, thanks for having us on.
And we have more on our website at capradio.org/insight. You are listening to Insight on your NPR station, Capital Public Radio. You're listening to Insight on Capital Public Radio. I'm Randall White in today for Beth Ruyak. Sacramento's music scene continues to heat up with rising local talent and nationally known artists performing around town. In this week's Sound Advice, we're going to highlight three shows worthy of adding to your calendar. Joining us today is Jonathan Caraba, the co-founder of Submerge Magazine. And Jonathan, welcome back to Insight.
Thanks. Great to be here.
Yeah, nice to sit across the table from you, Jonathan. It's been a while since we had you on the show. How are things looking at Submerge Magazine in 2019?
Things are good. This is an exciting time of year, especially with, all the outdoor events kicking in, festival season. I just was at a killer event this last Saturday called Soul Bloom that I believe you guys covered, and just a fantastic event. The weather is amazing, so I'm ready to get outdoors for some concerts. And
I'm feeling that around town.
The vibe is there. And Concerts in the Park kicks off tomorrow, actually.
Right. Yeah.
So Friday, and that's an every Friday free concert series at Cesar Chavez Plaza downtown, and it's just a killer time. Every week, there's thousands of fans down there, and it's really a festival environment.
Yeah. Well, today you picked three really different artists, a little something from everybody. Let's start with a song from Bassy Vibe. What's the track?
So Bassy Vibe is a local singer, songwriter, producer, amazing keyboard player and vocalist. He's been on our radar for a while, and we're really excited to have him on the cover of our current issue. He is playing Concerts in the Park next week, Friday the 10th, and we're going to hear a track called Morning Wood off his Somnus EP.
Yeah, B-A-S-I-V-I-B-E. Baby, there ain't nothing to do with here. Oh, what we supposed to do? Baby, there ain't nothing to do with here.
All right, so that's Bassy Vibe, and he was sort of in the background before, right, as a supporting artist?
Yeah, you'll see him in a lot of different forms, like, seen him with just his keyboard and vocals, and he's awesome that way, with a full band. He hosts a cool night at a bar downtown called High Water every so often, where he's bringing in, like, jazz players and stuff, so really versatile, really cool, like, soulful, breezy, modern sound, so I'm really excited to see, what this guy can do, and really excited to see him on the big stage at Concerts in the Park.
And he's really emblematic of what's happening in Sacramento.
Totally. He's, like, a part of this, like, really creative scene of musicians, with the Philharmonic and James Cavern and the Warehouse Artists Loft scene downtown. There's just a lot of stuff coming out right now that's really exciting.
Let's move on to Jeremy Enoch. This song is Light and Shadow from his 2017 record, Ghosts. Okay, I think Jeremy Enoch has a very late 60s, early 70s Summer of Love San Francisco sound. Some people might recognize the name and voice. Tell us a little about him.
So Jeremy Enoch is best known as the lead singer of a highly influential rock, like indie rock band called Sunny Day Real Estate. So a lot of people will recognize that band name or some of their work. He also has... he's just an incredibly powerful songwriter. He has a number of amazing solo releases. He often tours with, just a guitar and him, and even playing like living rooms sometimes. So really intimate. But this time he's coming through town next week, Tuesday, May 7th, to play Holy Diver. And he's bringing a full band with him to play cuts off of that 2017 release Ghosts, which is a great album. So that's pretty exciting to see that he's bringing more musicians with him to kind of fill out the sound and do that album justice live. So that should be a killer show.
The information is coming from Submerge Magazine co-founder Jonathan Caraba for this week's Sound Advice. We have one more concert to preview. According to Bazooka, this is their new song, I'm Not Really Here.
Mm-hmm. my head again. Forgot what I said again. I won't shed a tear, 'cause I know that I'm not really here. Woke up at 5:50. Everything's not what it seems. Looked right in the mirror.
Okay, Jonathan, tell us a little bit more about According to Bazooka.
So they're this really fun group. They play, as you can hear, like a cool blend of folk and pop, elements of rock, rockabilly country, even Zydeco. I love the use of accordion. I think accordion is an underused instrument, in my opinion. The bass player plays a stand-up bass. They harmonize vocally beautifully. And they're regulars at a lot of breweries and tap rooms and a lot of local venues like Fox and Goose, which is where they have an album release show coming up later in the month on May 17th. Their new album's called The Devil's in the Details. They will actually be featured in our next issue of Submerge coming out next week. So we'll have a nice in-depth interview with them so that our readers can get to know them more. Yeah. It's a really cool local band that I think a lot of people will enjoy. They're just fun.
Yeah, I was going to say in a word, fun.
Yeah. Fun.
Jonathan Carrabba from Submerge Magazine with a look ahead for upcoming concerts in this week's Sound Advice. Jonathan, thank you so much for being here on
nice
Insight.
To be here. Thank you.
And that is Insight for today. I'm Randall White, in for Beth Ruyak. Insight produced by Bert Johnson, Kate Gonzalez, and Cody Drabble. Digital team Chris Hagen, Casey Gardner, and Emily Zentner. Technical director Mark Jones. Today's engineer Anthony Van Hook. Senior producer Helen Barrington. Insight's executive producer is Joe Barr, and we're back with another live show on Monday. Thanks for joining us.